Okay, this is actually the first talk I'm going to be giving, launching this book. So this is number one. I'm going to do some other talks at other Tree Ratna centres over the next few weeks. So this is number one, starting here in West London. And I'm very happy to be doing that because I always feel this is my centre, you know. This is a short little talk. Mostly I'm going to be talking about the book, which I'm very proud to be launching. Supposedly tonight was supposed to be about the perfection of jhana, jhana paramita, which is not disconnected from this at all, but I'm going to come back next week and give that talk. Yeah. Anyway, when we're talking about meditation, it's always good to think about the Buddha, and it's quite clear that from the texts that have come down to us, that the Buddha was someone with a real gift, a really exceptional gift of imagination. So trying to get into what he was like. I mean, he was... We could close that door, couldn't we? Oh, okay, all right. Let's not be hot. Let's be fresh and open and relaxed, like me. So the Buddha, pretty much the same as us in a way. You know, he's the same. He was a human being like us. Had a head and two ears. You know. And had exactly the same basic experience. Like us, he saw things. Like most of us, anyway. He saw things. He heard things. He smelled things, you know. He had ideas. He experienced pain and pleasure. And he felt emotions. But the Buddha also had this amazing ability to grasp the essence of things, to sort of grab hold of the pith, as it were. And he was a pithy guy, you could say. He always saw the essential point with incredible clarity. And then, that was one aspect. And along with that quality, he had a tremendous feeling for other people, tremendous empathy, tremendous ability to empathize. So he could look at them and really, really see them. And he could use his imagination to help others pinpoint whatever were the important issues of their own lives. That was the way he always worked. He got them to see what was going on. He didn't just tell them. That doesn't work. But he got them to see. And so they could see a way out of their dissatisfaction and their distracted mental states, or whatever it happened to be. And for the Buddha, the real essence, the thing that really was the pith, as it were, for everybody, in all people, as well as being essential in the very nature of things, this was the mind. The mind that we're using now to try to figure out what I might be getting at. You know, the same mind, that mind. The mind that feels, the mind that holds experience. The Buddha saw that that's where all problems, as well as all solutions, lie. The mind, you could say, was the Buddha's main interest in life. So it's not surprising that one of the very earliest recorded sayings from the Buddha is about the omnipresence of the mind, the fact that it's everywhere. He said, and you've probably heard this loads of times before, he said, experiences are preceded by mind. Experiences are led by mind. Experiences are produced by mind. So, if you act or speak with an impure mind, problems are inevitable. It's just like when you've got an ox, you've got a big ox, it's tied to a cart. When the ox lumbers forward, the cart comes along with the ox. Just like that. So experiences are preceded by mind. Experiences are led by mind. Experiences are produced by mind. So if you act or speak with a pure mind, happiness is inevitable. It's inevitable. It's just like when the sun shines. You get a shadow appearing on the wall behind you. It's just an automatic thing. So that's a really old saying of the Buddha. So the mind really is the key. It's the key to change, the key to liberation, happiness, compassion, wisdom. And the Buddha taught lots of ways of working with the mind. And since he practiced these methods himself, he was an example of their effectiveness. And we have these descriptions of what the Buddha was like from early texts like the Purabeda Sutta. And reading that, in some ways, this is a bit surprising. I think of the Buddha as a teacher. I can have this particular image of the Buddha as a teacher. So I tend to think of him as doing a lot of talking. Actually, apparently, he didn't go on and on all the time. He was quite restrained in his speech. He only spoke when it seemed appropriate. The rest of the time he was silent. He was actually called the Shakyamuni, the silent sage. And when he did speak, apparently his words, they never had any edge of irritation or any of the awkwardness that comes from anxiety. They never had the slightest sort of pushiness or arrogance. You know, all these things you usually pick up in people's speech. And it came across at once that this was someone with no strong desire for a particular outcome from the dialogue. So he was gentle and easy to be with. And what really struck people was that the Buddha was, as it were, he was moderate. A very moderate guy, you know. You never got a bad feeling from his sense of conviction. You know, he was convinced about what he was teaching. He was very confident, totally confident, but there was nothing obsessive about what he was telling you. He didn't have a big issue about it. Quite sort of dispassionate in his teaching, you could say. So I suppose because his confidence was quite fearless, he could be relaxed and gentle with it. And apparently it was obvious that he didn't consider himself superior to you. So this put you at your ease. But at the same time, he obviously didn't consider himself inferior to you either. You know, and indeed, he never gave you the sense that he felt you were equals either. Yeah? In other words, there was none of that comparative sort of evaluation going on in his mind. It's like, it's a rare thing. It seemed that the Buddha was completely at peace with himself. And that created a special quality of friendliness, a particular kind of atmosphere around him. And of course, he had enemies like all influential people do. Once you become famous, there are lots of people who don't actually know you but have heard about you. So he was famous and people were always talking about the Buddha and his ragged community of beggars. You can just imagine the kind of speculations that would be going on. And they often got criticized and accused of all kinds of misdemeanors. And none of it ever bothered him. You know, if the criticisms were true, he just did what he could. If they weren't true, he never got upset. Basically, he never got caught up in non-existent problems. A special quality, I think. And the Buddha knew that one way or another, this was the kind of mind that everyone needs to create for themselves. They can create it for themselves. It's a kind of creative, unfazable mind that sees opportunities rather than problems. So he taught us, this is what he taught, this the kind of behaviour, the kind of meditation, and the kind of wisdom that would develop that quality, the quality he exemplified. So acting, meditating and viewing things that way, you would simply develop a new mind. A shiny new mind. You know, that new mind would still be you with your own unique character, but essentially it would be similar to the Buddha's mind. You know, that is, as I've been trying to convey, you know, relaxed, moderate, at peace, and not caught up in unnecessary problems. That creative, unfazable mind. So these three trainings in behaviour, meditation and wisdom, they combined in what the Buddha called the practice of Sati Sampajanya. Sati Sampajanya means mindfulness and clear comprehension. We shorten that nowadays to simply mindfulness. That's what we mean when we talk about mindfulness. And mindfulness was the Buddha's core practice. It was the direct way, he said, of cultivating the awakening he had realised. And nowadays it's amazing that, you know, a simple application of mindfulness is popular, you know, in the NHS and in business in this country and in the States and right across the Western world. You know, somebody can become a mindfulness therapist now, I think, without knowing anything about Buddhism at all. And people complain. They complain that this is going to water the Dharma down. But surely it's a good thing that mindfulness is out there in the mainstream, even if it's a bit elementary. The thing is, it frees the experienced Buddhist teachers and mentors to teach the Dharma more deeply and more explicitly. You know, it challenges us actually to come up with the real thing. It's good for us. It's good for everybody. So I hope, getting around to the topic, you know, I hope this new book I've written will help that. You know, I very much hope it's going to help more people appreciate the incredible potential of the Buddhist path and to bring that to life in themselves. So let me just say a little bit about what I've written. I won't say too much because I'd like us to have some time for questions and discussion. With a title like that, the book is going to be about meditation. Title is Buddhist Meditation, Tranquility, Imagination and Insight. And it's about meditation, plus lots that explores the ethical and practical conditions that help you to meditate. And also to cultivate wisdom through meditation. And there are so many meditation practices in the Buddhist tradition. Historically, the Buddha specialized in meditation. The Buddha is said originally to have taught 40 distinct kinds of practice, meditation practice. And that's already, 40 is already quite a few, isn't it? But that's nothing, you know. You know, those have been adapted and extended over the 2,500 years the tradition has been going. So now there are many, many, many more. And the Tree Ratna community draws on a number of these. Probably not even 40. Yeah. Of course, I've written about the main practices. I've written about the ones we recommend, basically. The ones we find useful. But we also recommend quite a number of less known meditations that are useful in certain circumstances. And I explore why you do these, how they work, and I give a bit of instruction in how to explore them and bring them to life. Some of those methods are fairly advanced, which means that for complete newcomers, there'll be a proportion of the book they can't put into practice at the moment. But still, just to read about a practice can help us understand a point of Dharma. Because each meditation is a way to put the Dharma into practice and realize the Dharma. So, for example, we won't all feel ready to meditate on Pratityasamutpada. Pratityasamutpada is based on the Buddha's experience of conditioned co-arising, which supposedly was his central realization, the realization that sparked his full enlightenment. We might not feel ready to meditate on that right now, but on the other hand, if you're looking to go a bit deeper into the teachings of Buddhism, you'll soon come across Pratityasamutpada, and it's a real education to see how, in the tradition, Pratityasamutpada is applied in your experience, in an actual meditation exercise. You know, you could even try it out a little bit. So I think that's useful. I think reading about it can get your imagination going. And you get a new angle on that particular teaching. So because even reading about meditation can be useful, you know, it's no substitute, but it can be a useful thing in its own right, I've tried to make this new edition a lot more readable, so that if you can, if you want, you can just read it through out of interest. You know, Bodhi Lila says it's not the sort of book you want to read through, but I've tried to make it the sort of book you could read through, if you like. I just say, it came out in 1992. I've revised every sentence in the book. I've really tried to transform the whole thing. The material isn't all advanced by any means. Most of what I say consists of in-depth instruction in the kind of meditation most of us are already doing. But in addition to that, there's material that's just a little bit further on for beginners and regular meditators. So it could help you explore your next step. For example, I explore the basic meditations, mindfulness of breathing, metta bhavana, and just sitting, from the perspective of cultivating insight, as well as from the more usual perspective of cultivating tranquility of mind, peace. So in general, I'm setting out the principles that determine why we practice particular approaches, what those approaches can achieve, and how those different approaches relate to one another in a complete practice. While I was doing this rewriting, which has taken me a year, Subhuti and Sangharakshita, these are quite senior bods in the Triratna order, they started discussing the new, broader approach to our system of spiritual practice that we are just starting to hear more about now. And they wanted me to get in the picture early with this material so I could write it into the new book. So though my way of expressing things is very different from theirs, I think this is going to be, well, I hope this is going to be a useful hands-on guide to this new approach. So according to the title of the book, there's first tranquility, learning how to calm and steady the mind. That's the first thing. Then the second, there's imagination, where you work in all kinds of special ways to deepen the practice. Thirdly, there's insight and compassion. I'd like to use those two words together, because they are the same thing, where the transformation starts to change you fundamentally, and I mean to change who you are. So first of all, we all need to learn concentration and positive emotion, a positive heart, a kind heart. We need to learn how to bring those things about and express both of those things in daily life. This is how, where it comes down to. And that's done through mindfulness. Mindfulness is what carries what you learn from meditation all the time into your life. But there's also a meditation that helps you establish mindfulness, and that's called just sitting. I know there's the mindfulness of breathing, but that's a little bit different, because it's mindfulness of the breathing which promotes concentration. The practice that really brings mindfulness itself to life is just sitting. Just sitting really means sitting and being open to what's real. Because at the heart of mindfulness is simply receptivity. The willingness to be open. Truly open to what's actually happening in your mind and out there as well. So what is happening beyond all our explanations of what's happening and our ideas about what is happening, beyond the emotional reactions that we have to what seems to be happening, you know, beyond the strategies and the forward planning we're constantly involved in relation to what seems to be happening. Well, you can actively cultivate that openness. So just sitting, in which you simply sit there, is very helpful. But I'd say not on its own. You also need metta bhavana. You also need a loving mind. And you also need to be cultivating a concentrated, purified attention to through anapanasati, through mindfulness of breathing. So these are all basic meditations. I'm not going to say very much more. These are the basic meditations we all learn. And you can find out about them in a lot of detail. And there's loads more, actually, which I write about, because having learnt the basics, you then need to learn to sustain the practice, to keep it live, to keep it interesting, to keep it relevant and keep it inspiring. Meditation's great when you start, but you need to keep it up, even when it's difficult. So I talk about ways you can keep it alive. For one thing, it helps to go on retreat. You know, easy example. And in the book, I go into all the principles of retreat life, including how to set up for yourself at home all the special conditions that give extra support for meditation. And another thing in sustaining the practice is meditation posture. You know, the principles of that, the different ways to sit, tips you can apply that are going to help your toes from going numb and your back from seizing up. And then as you progress in the practice of the Dharma, generally, certain signs appear in the practice. So it's a good idea to learn something about, you know, those higher states of consciousness, about the principles of dhyana, it's called. You know, the mind has all these amazing capabilities. And we can all taste some of those. And at least it's good to understand something about the value of those kinds of experiences. For example, that they're not the end point of practice, but more of a spin-off effect from the overall momentum of what you're doing. So I have quite a bit to say about various meditative states like these and their relative value and importance. And that chapter, you know, it's a chapter, I hope that's going to indicate something deeper about the kind of reality we're all living in. You know, the world is certainly not how it appears. And once you start seeing that, then the real transformation can take place. So later chapters in the book are more about the cultivation of wisdom, the various approaches to that, and also the pitfalls to that. It's always very useful, I think, to have some sense of the mistakes you can learn to avoid, even if you still don't avoid them. It's also helpful to learn to understand that some things that appear to be problems are just stages on the way, or even just the ordinary conditions of life, but you think they're something special or something terrible or something like that. I'm not going to go into any technicalities now, but I think the overall message needs to be that the way you view things is the important thing. You know, get the view right, and the path is going to unfold in the best possible way for you. This was going back to the Buddha. This was his teaching of the Eightfold Path. You know, first comes the vision, and out of that comes the transformation. at first our overview of things, the way we view things, is imperfect. It needs working on. But as we work to understand things better, what the path of spiritual progress is all about, our view improves. And our view, our attitude, call it that, it directly affects how we practice the rest of the path. So overall, I just wanted my book to contribute to people's ability to imagine and envision the spiritual path and to open up the imagination rather than not doing that, rather than just blindly sort of carrying on regardless. And on the basis of that vision, when you practice meditation, you'll get its fruits. So I've just got a little few things here to say about the fruits of meditation. When do we get these fruits? You may ask, you know, when do we get these fruits? Well, people often expect that the results of meditation should show up in the meditation itself. Maybe that's understandable. But they think, here I am meditating, where are the fruits of the practice? So they're sitting there making an effort to engage with the practice, and by effort, in this context, of course, I mean relaxing, facing towards their experience. It's a kind of an effort, right? Relaxing is a kind of an effort because you have to apply it. It's something you know, the resistance is in wanting to be tense, right? So relaxing, facing towards the experience you're having, and re-engaging again and again with the object of the meditation, which might be, say, the breathing. And depending on the various conditions in your life, it may not seem to be working. And you stay with the breath for a while, then you drift off thinking about something you need to do later, or whatever grabs your attention. In fact, the whole practice, let's say, is like that, just one distraction after another. But still, you do manage to keep remembering and coming back to the object. This is really good. But people who have that experience often think, that didn't work. That didn't work. Now, the reason they have this view that it didn't work is because they're fixated on a particular kind of result. They're expecting a particular kind of result then and there. There's some idea they have, we have, you have maybe, in their heads, these people. Probably some image of being very concentrated and engaged, some kind of image of how it would be. But if they really do keep re-engaging with the breathing, there will definitely be a fruit of those efforts later on. It'll be later on in another meditation. It'll be later on in your own thoughts as you walk along the street. It'll be later on in a conversation or in some thoughts you have late at night, in the middle of the night when you wake up. So that's how it usually works, much more like that, sometimes even quite a bit of time later. You know, all our actions have consequences. Some actions have deep consequences. You know, there are some negative actions that have deep consequences, right? But there are positive actions that have deep consequences. And meditation is one of these. In traditional terms, it's a weighty action, a weighty karma, a substantial act with substantial consequences. So don't underestimate the effect of the practice, and don't expect the result to come straight away. And what kind of results can we expect, or should we have noticed? Well, actually, I think one should be careful not to have too exact expectations of how your life is going to unfold in this way. Everyone's different, and usually they're very different. And the most important fruits of meditation are the subtle ones. One example is in the amazing faculty of empathy, which I mentioned earlier. Really, the most essential thing you're doing when you meditate is getting familiar with your own mind. It's a long process, mainly because we've got so many opinions already about who we are and what our mind is. We really do. And all of these deeply held opinions, and also very emotionally held opinions, need at least revising. Actually, most of them just need abandoning. And meditation helps with that by bringing us closer and closer to the reality of our own minds. And as you become gradually more familiar with your own mind, and on the way becoming more receptive and easy with yourself, accepting yourself more and more confident regarding yourself, as this happens, you also at the same time are becoming more familiar with what it is to have a mind in the first place. It's a weird thing, right, to have a mind. It's a strange thing. Something, in a way, very familiar, yet something rather unfathomable. Everyone has a mind. Everyone has this experience of mind, but they don't normally think about that. So, as something very basic that can remain unrecognized. But meditating, and we all have this, you know, we train in recognizing this something. This is what basically is happening. We're training in recognizing this something, this quality of experience that cannot even be described adequately. But it's right there all the time. This growing understanding of the quality of mind, completely intuitive, completely wordless understanding in all things, automatically links you intimately with others and automatically teaches you to understand all other people. That's how the Buddha became like he did. And it's how we become like the Buddha. You know, I won't say more. There's too much to say. But very generally, I hope very much that my new book will help support and advise everyone's meditation practice, including my own. I have to take my own advice. Either because you yourself actually buy and study it, or because teachers do. We all know that reading a book can't substitute for actual practice, but it can clarify our understanding and then get us practicing, and practicing more effectively and hopefully more enjoyably and rewardingly. So, there you have it. Thank you.